Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, Sarah Baker, Legislative and Policy Director for the ACLU of Missouri, will discuss voter rights with an emphasis on Missouri. From her professional vantage point working in Jefferson City, Baker details the various ways she believes the GOP is trying to keep certain populations from voting. Baker argues that these tactics are undemocratic and put obstacles in front of the voters who are least likely to make it to the polls. She shares examples of this and the impact of the new voter ID laws. This show is recorded on February 4th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Welcome to the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Forum. The purpose of the forum is the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. The right to vote is a fundamental pillar of our democracy. This morning, we will be discussing access to that right. Sarah Baker is the Legislative and Policy Director for the ACLU of Missouri. She is responsible for working with elected officials and community organizations on issues related to the rights of all Missourians. She has served as a Special Projects Manager and Stephen M. Rivers Memorial Fellow at the Center for Democracy in the Americas in Washington, D.C. While at the Center for Democracy in the Americas, Sarah provided research for the role of women in Cuba's evolving economy and worked directly with high-level congressional delegations to the island. Sarah instructed and organized students in the Global Citizenship Program at Washington University in St. Louis. At Washington University, she served as a policy fellow for the American Association of University Women, where she advocated for legislation to curb sexual assault on campus and in favor of equal pay. Outside of academia, Sarah worked with the International Institute in St. Louis to resettle refugees and help them access state and federal benefits. Sarah holds a Bachelor's of Arts in International and Area Studies in Spanish and a Master's of Arts in International Affairs, both from Washington University. Please help me welcome Sarah Baker.
Thank you, everyone, and good morning. I see some familiar faces in the crowd. That is always heartwarming. As Linda said, my name is Sarah Baker. I'm the Legislative Director with the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri. I'm delighted to be here with you today on this rather chilly Sunday. Boy, have we taken a turn from yesterday. I'm also delighted to be back in Kansas City, which I'm proud to call home at the moment. Although I live in Jefferson City for 5 months of the year during legislative session, so really I-70 is home, but it's nice to be back for a weekend. So I'm here to talk about voting rights, and I know for most of you this subject is not new, but the power to choose who governs is one of the most dignified rights that we all share. When we vote, we're convening a national dialogue through which we decide our individual and our collective future. Yet throughout our history, withholding the right to vote has been a way to impose second-class citizenship on people who threaten the status quo. At different points throughout our history, the United States has denied the right to vote to white men without property, to African Americans, to women, to Native Americans, to Chinese Americans, and adults under the age of 21. Today, we look with shame at those periods. We are ashamed that it took the 15th Amendment in 1870 to prohibit the denial of the right to vote on account of race or color, when we should have understood that as a nation founded on the ideals of equality, that was inherently wrong. Today, standing on the shoulders of giants who came before us, we must realize equality in our state and in our country. Brief aside, that does not just apply to voting rights, realizing equality. But I know, as that's the subject that I've been invited to talk about, I will try to stick on theme. However, later on when we have a brief bit in the library to chat, I'd love to talk to you about the ways in which we can realize equality in the matters of criminal justice, reproductive justice, immigration, privacy, and the First Amendment, all of which are issues pertinent in the state of Missouri and desperately in need of your attention. Now I'm transitioning smoothly back to voting rights. You'll see that that was seamless. Not so long ago, African Americans who wanted to exercise their right to vote were beaten, chased by dogs, bludgeoned by police, and sometimes killed. It is unimaginable that African Americans, many, were only allowed to vote within recent memory with the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. I was taught that in school as history, but it remains a contemporary reality for many. Today, subversive strategies like voter ID have been implemented to block, most recently, African Americans and other minorities from the ballot. This moment we're in right now is the modern civil rights movement. The Supreme Court once described the right to vote as a civil right of the most fundamental significance under our constitutional structure. Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote in Reynolds v. Simmons that the right to vote freely for the candidate of one's choice is the essence of a democratic society, and any restriction on that right strikes at the heart of representative government. However, it was also the Supreme Court that bears some of the responsibility for how we got to where we are today. In 2013, in Shelby v. Holder, the Supreme Court declared part of the Voting Rights Act, that act I talked about from 1965, unconstitutional. Without Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, states are now free, without federal oversight, to make election-related changes that could adversely affect racial and language minorities. Section 5, which the court called into question, was designed to check what certain states could do in attempts to circumnavigate the 14th and 15th Amendment by placing unconstitutional barriers on one voting practice after another. This was necessary given how many states leading up to the passage of the Voting Rights Act used an array of tactics to limit the rights of those to vote. Those included white-only primaries, literacy tests, poll taxes, of which we're all aware from our history lessons, violence and intimidation, and all sorts of ways to suppress the minority vote. As one method was deemed unconstitutional, another method took its place. The courts were playing what I like to call unconstitutional whack-a-mole. It's a game I'm very familiar with working in the Missouri legislature. The court found in 2013 that certain parts of the Voting Rights Act impose current barriers that were no longer responsive to the moment that we're in today. I think that's wrong. We're still living in a society where racism is very real, and a lot of the problems that we saw in the 60s still persist into the modern era. Just hours after the court released its decision in Shelby, Texas announced that it would implement its voter ID law that had been blocked under Section 5 because of its discriminatory impact. This leads us to where we are right now, with more states becoming more and more restrictive on the right to vote and who gets to vote and when they get to vote. Across the country, we've seen legislators use ghost stories about voter fraud to restrict voting rights. These laws are part of an ongoing strategy to roll back decades of progress on voting rights and more largely civil rights as a whole. 34 states have identification requirements at the polls. 7 states have strict voter ID laws in which voters must present a limited set of identifications in order to cast a regular ballot. Guess what? Missouri is one of them. In 2016, Missouri voters passed a constitutional amendment allowing for voter ID in our state. It passed by an overwhelming majority. We're talking about 63% of the vote in Missouri. Missouri voters were told time and time again that voter fraud was rampant, and it was their obligation to protect the integrity of the vote by passing this constitutional amendment. Now, mind you, we had to pass the constitutional amendment because earlier, when the state had tried to pass voter ID through the legislative process, it had been found, guess what, unconstitutional. It's like I need a rubber stamp. Missouri voters were told that they had to do this in order to protect the right to vote. That was a lie. In-person voter fraud is vanishingly rare. From 2000 to 2014, there were only 31 credible instances of voter impersonation fraud. And that's the only type of photo ID could actually have any hope of preventing. That's during a period in which over 1 billion votes were cast. This is very much a needle in a haystack problem and a problem in search of a solution that doesn't need one. What is true is that putting restrictions on how a person can vote definitely impacts who votes. Everyone thinks that everyone owns a photo ID, but that's not true. 11% of U.S. citizens, or more than 21 million Americans, do not have a government-issued photo ID. And a disproportionate number of those are low income, racial and ethnic minorities, and the elderly. We've seen this across all the states where we've studied voter ID. I'm going to share some quick figures with you. I know it's a little boring on a Sunday morning, but I think it's important to know the facts and figures that get us to the current problem. 18% of Americans over the age of 65 do not have a government-issued photo ID, so that's going to be a large sector of disenfranchisement. Nationally, up to 25%, a quarter, of African-American citizens of voting age lack government-issued photo ID. That compares with only 8% of whites who lack the identification. So we can see the disproportionate impact that that is going to have on our vote going forward. I don't even have to surmise that for you as something anecdotal. We can look to the states where it's already in progress and cases that have already gone forward to know its disproportionate impact. In Pennsylvania, the court found overwhelming evidence that there are hundreds of thousands of qualified voters who lacked a compliant voter ID in 2012. The state's own expert witness, said that that was between 4 and 5% of the registered voters in that state. That means 320,000 voters to 400,000 voters didn't have the right ID to vote in Pennsylvania. But what's more important than these statistics are the names and stories that are attached to them. We must know the names of people who are being disenfranchised by these laws. I'll give you just a couple. Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. is an African-American voter, and when he talked about the ordeals he had to go through to get a license to vote so that he could vote. He had to go on multiple 12-hour bus rides to and from his birthplace in Decatur, Illinois, to fetch the underlying documents that you need to get a voter identification. He was told that in order to amend his birth certificate, he would need to pay between $400 and $600. When he testified in court, he told the judge, "I don't have between 400 and 600 cents." Like millions of seniors, Dorothy Cooper, 96, didn't own a government-issued photo ID. She traveled twice to Fairbanks, Tennessee, to obtain one so that she could cast her ballot at her regular polling site where she'd always gone. Both times, she wasn't able to stand in line long enough to get her ID. Eventually, she was able to vote after her case received a lot of public attention, and the lieutenant governor intervened. I can guarantee you that that's not going to be the norm going forward with voter ID. Voter ID laws have already changed the nature of our election. A 2014 Government Accountability Office analysis of turnout in 2008 and 2012 looked at the impact that voter ID laws have on turnout across the nation. Specifically looking at Kansas, they found that voter ID laws led to an almost 2% reduction in the amount of voter turnout in the state of Kansas and a 2.2% reduction in turnout in the state of Tennessee. That is undemocratic. This reduction in turnout was most pronounced amongst African Americans, 3.7 percentage points more than amongst whites in Kansas, and 1.5 percentage points more than among whites in Tennessee. And it was disproportionately impactful on young people and those who had just moved and were just trying to register to vote. This is undemocratic. Restrictions on voting are often hypocritical and seem more focused on allowing this one type of person to vote and not that one type of person to vote. I'm going to share some of my favorite examples on this. Texas allowed concealed weapons permits for voting, but did not accept student ID cards. Until its voter ID law was struck down, North Carolina prohibited public assistance IDs and state employee IDs, which were disproportionately held by black voters. And until recently, Wisconsin permitted active duty military IDs, but prohibited Veterans Affairs ID cards from voting. The system is undemocratic. What is also undemocratic is how often our biases help the system to embody white privilege. An exit poll conducted after the 2008 general election in Boston found that black, Hispanic, and Asian voters were asked for IDs at much higher rates than other voters. 38% of Hispanic voters and 33% of Asian voters and black voters were asked for an ID when they went to the polls, compared to 23% of white voters. My husband has an accent. Inevitably, the first question he gets that he hates is, "Where are you from?" I cringe when I realize that when he becomes a U.S. citizen, the next question he might get is, "Where is your ID?" Why in Missouri do papers and not people allow us to see our fellow man as our neighbor? I want to talk specifically about Missouri. It's a state that I call home, and I imagine it's the state that many of you in the room also call home. For those Kansas folk, I apologize. I'm not going to talk much about Kobach, though there would be a lot to say about Kobach. As I mentioned earlier, Missouri recently became a state that requires voter ID, and we passed that overwhelmingly. We, the ACLU, not me personally, are already in court suing over the various provisions of that law. In Missouri, you have a few options when you go to the polls. Secretary of State Ashcroft would tell you, don't worry, it's easy, everyone can vote. Here are your options. You can go, you can show an improved photo ID, and then you can vote with a regular ballot. You can show a lesser form of ID, like that utility bill that you used to bring, and you can sign a statement that says, on penalty of perjury, I know that I'm required to have an ID. I don't have one, but I know the state would get me one. Or you can cast a provisional ballot. And if you cast a provisional ballot, that's what you can do if you do not have identification. That can be highly problematic. So provisional ballot sounds great, but there's a difference between provisional ballots and regular ballots. The biggest difference is one is more often counted than the other. Regular ballots, we count those. Provisional ballots, sometimes. So in Indiana, an estimated 14% of provisional ballots in Indiana were cast because folks didn't have proper identification. Only 1/5 of those ballots were verified. Of the provisional ballots cast in the 2012 Indiana primary due to lack of voter ID or a proper voter ID, 80% of those ballots were not counted. The problem with provisional ballots is you have to do one of two things. You have to either compare your signature to the one that they have on file for you, and then they can verify that you are who you say you are. That's a problem for any of us who have ever gone to a Walgreens or CVS and signed on that little thing, and we all know that our signatures don't look the same day in, day out, and under any given circumstance. Or you can cast your provisional ballot, go home, come back, and verify your ID. I don't know how many people have time for that. It doesn't seem like a lot, given that our voter turnout is so low in our country. I think that that poses a real barrier to entry into the democratic system. Also, we need to remember the people that this affects. Imagine if you're homeless, if you've moved recently, or that you don't have the time to request a voter ID because, you know, you have a life. At this moment, do all of you know where your birth certificate is? Like, exactly? Good work. Good crowd for this. I personally have a vague idea where it is. I think I could find it. How about your marriage license? This is the same crowd. I know you people. You're very organized. So my parents actually had theirs stolen out of their car in New York. So I wish them like really good luck with that should they ever need to provide that as an underlying document. That's the thing with getting this free voter ID in the state of Missouri. You have to get some underlying documents to prove who you are. That can be, for example, a birth certificate. The Secretary of State's office is supposed to help facilitate this process and help you out with the cost. That is a challenge that remains to be met, and we will be watching that very closely. It's going to be difficult for the state of Missouri, given that projections for voter ID said that it would cost Missouri $11 million, and we budgeted $3 million. It's going to be hard to make sure that everyone gets their free voter ID to vote. Only 55% of Americans do actually vote. I'm going to say that again, because I think it's really important. Only 55% of Americans vote. That's a 20-year low. The problems that I've been laying out for you before, they are real problems, and they're impacting people's lives day in, day out. But they're also distracting us from a core issue, which is we've got to get more people to the polls so that these laws cannot become laws the way that they are. I urge you not to let the distraction, the rhetoric around voter fraud, stop you from being active, stop you from taking action. Our state could be doing a lot to help voters. We could get rid of voter ID, and we're going to keep trying in court. Or we could make early voting easier. In the House right now in Missouri, there's HB 1283 and HB 1550, which would both help make early voting easier. Or we could automatically register people to vote. What a novel idea. Pass HB 1584, HB 2049, or HB 1934 in the Missouri legislature. Or we could do probably the easiest thing on this list, which is comply with the National Voter Registration Act and allow people to register to vote at the DMV. It's literally the law, and we should be doing that in the state of Missouri. I want you to continue to be bold, to continue to push when you see this injustice, and to stand up. I know it's tiring. Believe me, every week when I leave the Missouri legislature on Thursday, I am wiped. I can't see people anymore. I have to be alone for a few minutes. I urge you to take care of yourself, and I urge you to take care of your neighbors. The ACLU will keep fighting with you, knowing that freedom cannot protect itself. Our current time comes with immense challenges. There's a new one every day and every tweet. I'm going to make some assumptions. I'm going to say that you came here today because you care about someone or something in this room. That's pretty general. You are here because you're trying to understand, you're trying to find community, and trying to envision a more just world. Dorothy Height, an activist and a feminist, once said, "I want to be remembered as someone who used herself and anything she could touch to work for justice and for freedom. I want to be remembered as someone who tried. Please keep trying. We can fix our world together, and I look forward to seeing you many times before, but absolutely and positively at the polls."
We're going to open the floor for questions, one apiece until everyone's had a chance, and try to, of course, put your statements in the form of a question at least.
It's hard for me to get a handle on how many provisional ballots are being cast since the new laws went into effect because of what you described as sometimes they get counted and sometimes they don't. Do we have an idea as to how many votes are actually being lost because of this provisional ballot issue?
Great question. So I don't have that off of the top of my head to share. It is data that we're very interested in and we're trying to remain cognizant of and track down as soon as it becomes available. It is also information that we try to get during discovery as part of the lawsuit so that we know what ballots are being lost. What I can say is that the greatest impact of this law hasn't happened yet because we haven't had a major election in terms of, I think that all elections are super important. But we haven't had a midterm election. We haven't had a presidential election, which is where we see tons of people turn out. So it's from those elections that we're really going to see the numbers and the impact on provisional ballots. But we're working to get that other information, too. I don't have a ready statistic for you, but it's something that I think once people are more aware of, once we have that information done in a finite way, that we'll be able to share. Thank you for that question.
Good morning. If one pays attention to certain streams in the news, there's concern that there's an actual constitutional crisis brewing. And if we take a step back from the data that you reported, I thought it was interesting, the very first thing on your litany of historic grievances was white males who didn't own property. And it often seems like where we're at now is that the Tories, the people who landed, the landed gentry before the Constitution was framed even, have figured out a way to circumvent the Constitution entirely. And so I'm curious to understand, while we're recruiting people to fight these individual issues, what's the view from the ACLU about essentially saying it's time to have this out on a fundamental property is not person basis?
So I think to answer that question broadly first, you know, in terms of the constitutional crisis, we've seen not just one but a few since the new administration, and we've seen violations of the Constitution day in, day out. And we made a promise to President Donald Trump that we would see him in court. And that's the way that we have to combat this on an individual or sort of on an organizational basis. And that's the position of the ACLU, that when we see an unconstitutional violation, we will handle it in court. So that's what we're trying to do. In terms of property and people, I don't have a quick answer for you on that. But when we get into this idea of what are unconstitutional violations, the recourse of the ACLU is twofold. One, we see you in court. And two, we try to combat anything that suppresses the vote or other civil rights and civil liberties on a state level. So I work in the Missouri State Legislature. I'm currently tracking over 500 pieces of legislation that have various constitutional pitfalls to them. Some of them are actually okay. Some of those are pro-legislation. But what we have to do is watch that on the legislative side and watch that in a court. So when I'm not able, I kind of picture myself as like the goalkeeper before Tony Rothart, who's our legal director. And when something gets by me, the ACLU's position is we take it up in court, assuming that we can find plaintiffs to do so. I'm not sure that's like a nail on the head answer to your question, but the way in which the ACLU approaches these issues is first through our advocacy as much as we possibly can, and then through the courts when we were not able to address it earlier.
Very impressive talk. You make me proud to be an ACLU supporter.
Thank you.
So the stated rationale for passing these voter ID fraud laws, or the voter ID laws, is preposterous when you think about it.
Yep.
What does an individual have to gain by impersonating somebody else and casting a vote? There's essentially nothing to gain. And even if some organized group wanted to pay people to impersonate other people to vote, they would have no way to know whether they actually voted the way they were paid to be voted. Mm-hmm. Would you talk some about the ridiculousness of the stated rationale and what we have learned through some of the leaked information about what the real rationale is?
I mean, the real rationale is to suppress the vote. It's to say these people should vote and these people shouldn't vote, and we want to make sure that we maintain majorities that are really voter-proof, which I think is the most undemocratic thing that's probably come out of my mouth today. But that, I think, is the underlying stated goal. In terms of the ridiculousness that we've seen from this, I brought up the example of we're comparing 31 certifiable events to a billion. Last night I was Googling around trying to figure out how could I, picture a billion for everyone so that we could really get to the heart of how absurd that is. But I think the numbers speak for themselves. This is not something that that if we wanted to solve the problem of making sure that eligible voters are getting to the polls and voting, this was not the way to do it. This was a needle in a haystack. We're going to invent a problem. We're going to invent a solution. And we're going to push these things through so that they restrict the vote. I think we all saw with the Kobach Commission what the true purpose was around suppressing the right to vote. And this idea that there's rampant voter fraud is something that's just inaccurate and is meant to perpetuate fear in our society, that we have to stand up and protect our democracy from something, when in reality, we should be trying to push forward our democracy and make it more inclusive and make sure that people are turning out to vote at the polls. So I couldn't agree with you more that laws like voter ID are ridiculous. I think they're undemocratic. I think they do not solve a problem. The real push that we have to make now is making sure that we create solutions that create a more democratic society, because I think that that is part of what we can do to stand up and fight for our civil rights as a whole.
My name is Michael Jones, and I live in Kobach country, and I'm sorry to say. But I wanted to talk about the voter suppression that you've been talking about, coupled with the gerrymandering cases that seem to do the same thing in a little bit different way. And my second question would be, it seems like the Supreme Court at some point needs to get involved in this voter suppression. If there's a national law that says go to the DMV and get your ID, it seems to me that that's what should be done. And I would like to know what the ACLU is doing to kind of kick them in the butt.
So court cases take time, right? You got to do a lot of research. You got to find plaintiffs. You got to write the documents you need. You have to submit them. You have to choose the venue, all those sorts of things. So in terms of the fact that Missouri is not complying with the National Voter Registration Act, that is an issue that I expect very shortly will be taken up in court. It's also an issue that many folks have been advocating on in terms of doing advocacy letters and pushes to the Secretary of State and the Director of the Department of Revenue to make sure that Missouri is becoming more compliant or just compliant with the National Voter Registration Act. The way that that will work, if we do a court case and we win, I expect the state possibly to appeal. They could also, choose to fix the problem. That would be an interesting move. But if they appeal, then it will go up through the courts. And, you might see a case like this come before the Supreme Court at some point. But those cases take a really long time to get there. And you're likely to see several twists and turns along the way. I think with our registering at the DMV, I think we're very likely to push the state to comply on that one because it's just so obvious what they need to do there. I think on issues like voter suppression and voter ID, those cases are much more difficult because you have to essentially wait until it's too late in some instances. And I think that's deeply frustrating, right? Like, our numbers right now for our voter ID case aren't as compelling as they're going to be after the next midterm election or after the next presidential election. So it really disturbs me that we're going to have to watch further breakage of our system in order to build part of our case to say that this is wrong, even though we know in several other states throughout the country that this has had a disproportionate impact and these rules are unfair and unjust. We can point to all of those and we can push on those and we can use them to build up our argument, but I do feel like in the state of Missouri, we're the show me state for a reason, and until we have those hard numbers that we can pull from Missouri to say, look at what you did to our people, it's going to be a tough court battle. It's one that we're going to continue to fight day in, day out, and it's one that also in the Missouri legislature, there's not much I can do on voter ID now because it's a constitutional amendment, but we certainly are going to advocate hard for bills like the ones that I brought up that expand the right to vote in an effort to offset some of the discrimination that's going to happen. But fundamentally, I think that that's a court challenge, and just like we said to Trump, we'll see you in court.
So your focus has been on the voter ID laws, but one of the anecdotes you told seems to me to illustrate one of the other ways that voter suppression is occurring, is the underfunding of the electoral system apparatus, the closing of polling stations, not having enough machines at polling stations, so you have long lines and people who don't have time to stand in a long line just go home. Would you talk some more about that?
Yeah, that's a really great point. You know, one of the things that we could do to make voting a lot more accessible is to allow for early voting, so more absentee voting where you don't have to prove a reason why you're going to be out of the state, but you can just cast a ballot because you know that you're going to have to work that day. I think that that applies to so many people, and it would be a really common sense solution to part of this problem. But when you continue to underfund the electoral system, as you pointed out, you're going to get those long lines. You're going to get people leaving because they don't have time to do that. You're going to have machines that are broken down. You're not going to have enough election judges. Even worse than not having the election judges, you're going to have poorly trained election judges who don't know when you show up and you say, okay, I have my student ID, and they tell you, well, I don't, is that, and they have to look at their sheet, if they have their sheet, to know if that's the right form of identification you should have or you shouldn't have. When we underfund the system, we're underfunding the training that goes into making sure that our elections are free and fair. And I think that that is a problem that we're making worse at the current time. If we're going to have systems that suppress the vote in Missouri, and I don't think we should have those systems, but if we're going to couple that with underfunding them, we're going to lead into a position where the state is not equipped to help the people it promised to help to get a voter ID. Folks are going to turn away from the polls, and we're going to keep incentivizing this negative feedback loop where we have less people voting, and those people come to look whiter and whiter and whiter.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Johanna.
Hi. My name is Johanna Fisher. I'm a new member of this church. I wanted to respond to a question that a gentleman just asked about what is the ACLU doing about the fact that when people in Missouri go to the DMV, they're not getting automatically registered. So, of course, Sarah, as the director of legislation and policy, is going to hopefully challenge this in court. But there is something that the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition is doing here in the state of Missouri. The ACLU is part of that coalition, the League for Women Voters, along with 30 other groups, including a new people-led volunteer group that the ACLU started called People Power. We actually meet here at All Souls. So we will be actually doing activities to try and get the DMV to register people directly when they go to get their license. And the reason why that's not happening right now is because the DMV is a private entity, and so it's not a government entity, and that's why those things are not happening. So that's one of the major issues, and that hopefully is going to be resolved, as Sarah said. But we have many initiatives planned for this year, including increasing the amount of people who are trained as poll monitors, getting out, getting people registered, all different kind of activities, and those are going to start in March. In the meantime, our group is focused on protecting Dreamers at this moment. So if you are interested, of course, sign up at the ACLU website. You can also sign up at peoplepower.org, and I will make sure things get posted in both the Flame and Flickr. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a huge oversight on my part. The key element to advocacy, and I think this when I say it, but I don't say it as explicitly as Joanna just did, and I think that we all should, which is grassroots advocacy is incredibly important in making sure that we push back against these laws. So definitely sign up with People Power. We have a lobby day coming up in Jefferson City on March 7th for the ACLU. I encourage you to get involved with that. People Power has this nifty little map on their website where you can see all the events being posted, and you'll know what subject they're about, that you can go to any of those and make sure that you're protecting undocumented individuals, but also that you're working on voting rights issues. And that's very active in the Kansas City area in particular. There are other People Power groups across the state, but I've been so impressed by what's happening in Kansas City, and I encourage everyone to get involved with that as fast as possible and as forcefully as possible.
Hi.
Hello.
I think this issue is so difficult because it's not a legal issue. It's really an emotional issue, I think. And it stems from xenophobia and from, from racism and about how I think Americans feel about who has a right to vote. Mm-hmm. So I think when you talk to liberals, it becomes the language changes. It's about voter suppression. But when you talk to conservatives, it's a very patriotic act. Mm-hmm. So I think it needs to come to, I'm thinking, where do we compromise then? Because I think that was a really good point you brought up of who has a marriage license, right? How do you get birth certificates and things like that? So I'm thinking, this issue will never see a compromise until we see some kind of a common ground. I think each party, each group has to give a little, because their concern is, the conservatives' concern is, well, there's voter fraud. People who shouldn't be voting are voting. Okay, mm-hmm. that's a valid concern. People who shouldn't be voting should not be voting. Mm-hmm. But then all this issue, the liberals' issues about we need to get married, you need to, okay. So I'm thinking, what would be a common ground?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I really appreciate you laying that out, because I think it is one of the things that is not looked into enough, which is, why did we feel the need to have these laws in the first place? And I think you're so right that that comes from a xenophobic place, and it comes from a place where we're not welcoming each other as neighbors. And I think that there does have to be some sort of middle dialogue. I don't think that there has to be a compromise on things like voter ID. I do think voter ID was designed to suppress the vote, and I do think that it has to be something that we get rid of so that we make voting more accessible for individuals. But I do hear you on that cultural standpoint. And I think, when I'm in the legislature and I'm talking to mostly conservatives, some of the points I try to make are about your neighbor. The minute that someone knows someone that could be disenfranchised or sees that they have been, their mind changes. Or it starts to shift. It can take some time with Missouri legislators, but it starts to shift. And so one of the things that I think we can do, in addition to all the advocacy work that we're doing to go after the actual laws, is building community. There was an article I remember from WashU way back in the day when I was doing my bachelor's about bowling alone, and this idea that you need to create community within your sphere so that you have the stories to share and so that you act as a more unified unit, but also so that those fears can't build up as quickly. We've become a society that, by and large, I think is more isolationist, and I think one of the ways that we need to overcome the rhetoric that underlies voter ID and the actual implementation of the system is to start making sure that we're having those conversations in community, and that we recognize that my degree of separation from someone who vehemently disagrees with me is not that far, but I shouldn't be afraid to talk to them. And I think once you put a face in front of something, you humanize it a lot, and I think that that's one of the big pieces of work we need to do when it comes to voter suppression, but also when it comes to making sure that the civil rights of all are protected, because we have to see our rights as intertwined. We have to understand that a compromise on the Dreamers today could be someone else tomorrow, that all of our civil liberties are super connected, and that we work in a fabric that's a democracy, and when one tear happens, when one push that would, deport 800,000 people, when that happens, it's damaging to all of us, and we need to see it in the faces of our neighbors. So that's one thing that I think we could all try to do to bridge that divide, and I really appreciate your question.
Good morning. I am largely unversed about you know, what legal terms that a voter can vote or is a voter, right? A big disconnect for me in voting is that I, you know, with politicians in general, you can't really know exactly what they stand for. It kind of always seems like a ego play, or, you know, they're just trying to get the vote. Are there any laws that actually hold the politicians accountable for our vote that would actually,
It's called an election.
Yeah.
That's really what you got. So, did you have something else you wanted to add to that, or I don't want to cut you off?
Well, it just seems that the definition of a voter, it's kind of like a contract, right? Like you enter into an agreement with your selected official, and if there's no repercussions or accountability, I think that's a big disconnect, so...
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It is a disconnect. However, it is also the system of democracy that we have. We have representative government, which means that once you've elected that person, they're kind of free to do what they want to say that they represent you. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't still put public pressure on those individuals. You can call their offices. You can write. You can show up March 7th, for example. All of those things are ways in which you can keep pressure on. I also love it when constituents write op-eds that legislators have to respond to, or they see in their hometown paper and they realize, like, oh, there's a narrative getting out about me that I don't really like. And so that could affect my future prospect for election. But, you know, as I mentioned, the only way to hold an elected official accountable is really through an election. There are a lot of small things you can do in the meantime to make them uncomfortable about the decisions that they're making, but you can't force them to make a decision. So I think it's really important to go vote, obviously. But even before that, when we get into candidate selection, ask some of the questions that matter to you. You know, ask where they stand on criminal justice issue. So ask how they would deal with a cop who was involved in discriminatory policing. Ask what they would do about voting rights in the state of Missouri. Go to those candidate forums. And when you hear someone that says, yes, I'm going to do that, that, and that, and here's the history I have of fighting for those rights, then I think you can get behind that candidate. But you have to also recognize that if those questions are never asked and we just go with party titles and we say, this is how I'm casting my vote because they're a member of one party or the other, we're losing a lot of accountability there, too. So it's not just voting at the polls, which we have to do, but it's also vetting our candidates and making sure that they are going to be accountable because you've seen them multiple times, you've formed a relationship, and you know what they stand for. So they can't get there and totally disavow their values. And if they do disavow their values when they come to Jefferson City or go to Washington, D.C., it's our job to stand up and say, you do not represent me. You cannot speak for us as if we're a monolith, and I'm running for office. Would be a great thing to say, you know, as a counter to that as well, because they need competition. That's what keeps people... you know, on top of their game, and that's what makes sure that they remain faithful to their values. So...
My question is kind of about the voter registration and where those policies came from. Mm-hmm. So we moved from Iowa, and in Iowa you can show up the day to vote, register there at the polls for the first time ever, and vote. Or if you happen to have moved from a different city or a different part of town, you can change your registration right then.
Yeah, that sounds really beautiful.
Yeah, it was really nice. And then we moved to Kansas, and... I got my license in October or something like that, and I changed my address back in August. Both of those times I registered to vote because they give you the option to do so. But then when the election happened this last time, they told me that they hadn't received it, and you have to register 30 days before the election. And so that was very frustrating, and I cast a provisional ballot. But I was curious as to... Have those policies been around for a long time? Are those new things aimed at voter suppression, or are they longstanding? Is there some other reason to have you register in advance?
Yeah. So I am not an expert on the history of all the measures that have affected the ballot ever. I will say that when you mentioned Iowa and you mentioned those early voting systems, that is something we want to push for in the state of Missouri. We view that as an advance for voting rights. I'm not sure that I would have to do more research into the history of Missouri if we ever had an ability to do earlier registration than we have now, and it changed at some point. I do know now that the registration to vote, you have to be registered pretty far in advance and hope you don't change your address. And it can be very complicated when you're actually going to the polls. And we want to make sure that you can do same-day voter registration and things like that. And I know that the ACLU of Kansas actually is pushing really hard for a voting rights package in the state legislature to try to get things like that, same-day voter registration. So I can't give you an exact answer to your question without more research. I would say that these things ebb and flow. At the same time, I've found that when you give people more rights, it's pretty hard to take them away. So it's about getting to that point where we can have early voting in Kansas and we can have early voting in Missouri, because I think then if you enter into a point where you try to take that away, people will strongly question why you're doing that. So I could do a little bit more research on your question. That's my philosophical approach to your question. But
Hi. You might have answered my question, or this gentleman might have. I was just going to ask, it's just kind of a bleak-looking situation, but I was wondering, who's doing it right, or are there models that we could look to, or points of encouragement? So that's
yeah.
My question.
Well, there are many states who have implemented things like same-day voter registration, for example. There are many... and. I find it hard to narrow that question just to voting rights. There are several states and cities that are ahead of us when it comes to voting rights, as the gentleman just mentioned, Iowa, for example, in the early voting system. I don't think anyone has it perfect. I think that our democracy is imperfect, and we're always going to work to better that system. But I don't mean to cast a picture that this is totally bleak. Things can change very quickly. In the same way that we saw 34 states quickly adopt voter ID provisions, we could see 34 states quickly adopt automatic voter registration. Those things can happen in the span of an election. So I don't want to paint a picture that there's no hope that we're stuck in this system that will never allow people to be fully enfranchised. But I would say that, you know, from the 15th Amendment onward, we've been engaging in a battle for voting rights. No one has it right yet, but that's part of why we continue to fight. And there will always be new struggles that are put in our way. There will always be new models that are the model of the day. But some of the things that we can look to are states that already have same-day voter registration, states that allow folks to vote absentee without providing a verified reason for doing so. So those are the sort of systems that I hope we can put in place in Missouri and for some of the Kansas audience, Kansas as well. So there's no perfect model I can cite. It's something we're still striving for.
Hello. Hi. I'm wondering, you know, Missouri passed the constitutional amendment for voter rights, or whatever mm-hmm. you called it. Would a state law override that constitutional amendment, or do we have to put it back out to the voters of Missouri to change that constitutional
yeah.
amendment?
A state law would not override the change that we made to the Constitution. Changing the Constitution makes it very difficult to fight this law in court. And that's why they did it, right? Because once it's enshrined in the Constitution, it becomes much harder to move. And in fact, prior to the constitutional amendment, the state of Missouri had tried to pass a voter ID law that was struck down as unconstitutional. So that's why they went for the move of changing the Constitution. We would have to have another ballot initiative to try to remove that, another constitutional amendment to remove that from the Constitution. That's kind of the pathway forward on that. There's no state law that could say we're not going to follow that part of the Constitution.
You talked earlier about how a large part of your job is talking with fairly conservative legislators in Jeff City.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Try to give us some insight into their thinking. What's their perspective on these voter suppression laws? Do you hear overt racial animus? Do you hear mm-hmm. we want the Republican Party to maintain its political control? How do they rationalize these laws to themselves when it has such an obvious
yeah.
suppressive impact?
Yeah.
What's their point of view?
So I would say, well, first off, we're in a new session now. And now that they have voter ID as a constitutional amendment, their focus is totally off of it. They're like, great, we did that. No more need to talk about it, right? And when those discussions were going on, it wasn't so much overt racial animus that you would hear. It was this idea of patriotism and protecting the right to vote and what we need to do to uphold the integrity of our elections. I think that there is an
Is that a fig leaf, or did they really believe that?
I think there's true belief in that to some extent, you know, and I think that, I mean, it's hard to say exactly what's in their minds, but I think that I don't often completely doubt someone's intentions from the get-go. And I think that what we hear when we talk about voting rights, when we talk about voter ID specifically, we hear a lot of, we've got to prevent voter fraud. There's total buy-in, there's true belief into that idea that voter fraud is rampant and this is the way to fix it. And I stood up for my country by supporting this law. So I think that that's the outward posture. And I think it is also truly believed by some of them. I think internally, though, when it comes to political strategizing, there's the recognition that this will disenfranchise certain voters, and there's a lack of empathy, I think, with that. And there's also a recognition, someone brought up gerrymandering earlier, that maintaining control of the legislature is key to maintaining control of the system that we use for drawing districts, and thus, you know, this does ensure party support for longer and longer periods of time. So when you're getting at someone's true motivations, I often say I believe the best in someone until they prove me otherwise. I think voting on voter ID is part of the proof that despite the arguments that we brought up, despite the cases that we showed of this disenfranchising voters, I felt like they didn't care. Because they bought in so much more to this other rhetoric of, this might be problematic for some people, but everyone has a voter ID. This shouldn't be hard to do for folks, and we need to protect our elections because we're under attack. It really comes back to that point you made earlier about that xenophobic feeling of culturally it feels like the values that some of those legislators hold are under attack, and that's the kind of position that they're taking. So,
is there also a component of follow the money? Is this partly driven by Koch and Alec?
Perhaps. I don't know the exact dollars on that, you know, in terms of campaign endorsements and who got what in order to push these things forward. It is possible, though, and I know that there are studies out there that would address that question as well. I will say I think there are true believers, and then there are people who followed those true believers. And I think some of that might align with campaign finance, but I don't have the proof to point to for that. And I know there are other studies out there, but we don't delve as much into that element of it as trying to get at the underlying reasons that they're supporting that law.
This gentleman sort of preempted the question I got up to ask, but I just wanted to make a point of clarification. The DMV, Division of Motor Vehicles, is not a private entity. It's part of the Missouri Department of Revenue. But the regional offices were privatized. The operation of the actual field offices where you go to get your driver's license are privatized. I think under Governor Blunt, that was part of the so-called privatization.
So the DMV that you have an interaction with, though,
right.
That's
yeah.
Private. Mm-hmm. So the DMV that you're going there and you're saying, I need my license, they are private. And that's really problematic when we're farming out these core government responsibilities to private companies. We're not getting the results we need to make sure that folks are fully enfranchised. So the DMV that you have an interaction with, not the one that sits in nice offices in Jefferson City, that is private, and I think that is problematic.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
I want to, again, thank Sarah and remind you that next week the topic will be Evangelical Takeover of the Republican Party by Charles Broomfield. And you're invited to stay for the service. Sarah has agreed to stay a few minutes, and we can go to the library for anyone else who has a little more information they want on some of the topics she talked about earlier or the voter suppression. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Truths About Voter Suppression with Sarah Baker. This program was recorded on Sunday, February 4th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.